Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Maximilian!
Hey, how you doing, Creed?
Good.
Oh, me too. Except my arm has really been bothering me.
Oh, no, Dad.
Oh, yeah. It's becoming a claw! Nothing can stop the claw! Run, boy, run! Save yourself!
To the claw to mom, Dad! To the claw to mom!
Uh-oh. You found the claw's only weakness. Sub-zero temperatures!
Oh, this is the happiest moment of my entire life.
Oh? Well, mine. Well, ours. Also.
Hey, Gipper. I have something for you, young man. Ooh, watch yourself. It's the claw. Ooh, the claw's coming at you. Ooh, you're scared of the claw. You're scared of the claw. Ooh.
Jerry.
Here. Huh?
It's okay. You don't have to.
Part of what I love about the new series is new music, so I always like to find some good tunes to rock out to. So we're starting a series for the summer called the Red Letters, and if you have an older one of those printed Bible things, you'll notice that oftentimes the stuff that is in red letters is the stuff that, anybody? Jesus said, yeah, so it's what why there were... They always would put the stuff that Jesus said in red letters. As a matter of fact, if you have YouVersion on your phone, if you go to settings, you can scroll to the very bottom of settings. There's a thing you can switch on the red letter function. So in the Gospels, you kind of expect to find stuff that Jesus said. But what's always, I think, helpful is sometimes you'll see things over in the stuff that Paul wrote, like 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Romans. Every once in a while, you'll see something in there where Paul will write, because Jesus said, or because the Lord said to me, and there's a words in red over here somewhere. So it's kind of helpful in that sense. But this summer, we're just really going to be looking at stuff that Jesus said. It's a series that really, if you miss any one of the weeks, it's okay, because nothing really kind of connects with others than the fact that the stuff that Jesus said. Whereas like in a series like Habits, if you miss the first week, it's sometimes kind of hard to figure out what's going on in later weeks. So I figure with your summer schedules going in and out, we just kind of spend the summer listening to the stuff that Jesus said. And so the other part that I hope to kind of accomplish with this is to kind of give you some insight into Bible study. It's people are always saying, I wish I could study the Bible better. And so hopefully along the way, I'll just drop some kind of different things out there to help you understand the Bible when you read it on your own. And so with that, we're going to start in Luke chapter 14. Why? Just because there's a lot of red letter stuff in Luke 14 and as good a place as any to start. The book of Luke is, Luke was a historian, and sometimes when he writes, he does things in chronological order, and there are some chronological pieces to the book of Luke. For instance, in chapter 9, he says that Jesus resolutely turned his face towards Jerusalem. In other words, from Luke 9 on, he is on his path to the cross. He is starting his journey to the cross. And then when you get to the end of Jesus' life, the last week, and I give you some chronological stuff that happens towards the end. But a lot of the rest of the content of the book of Luke is grouped together sort of thematically. In other words, he's kind of talking about a topic, and you'll even notice in chapter 14, he'll start off, and he's talking about one topic throughout all of chapter 14, but Jesus would talk about this at various times. So he's like, so this one time he's in the house of a Pharisee, and this thing came up, and so he had this conversation, which goes right along with this thing he said when he was on the road with his disciples, which goes right along with something that he said on the Sermon on the Mount. And you'll see all of those things right here in Luke chapter 14, which I find it comforting, because sometimes back in seminary school, preacher school, whatever you want to call it, we would have this debate, and sometimes people even ask me now, whether it's better to preach verse by verse through something or whether it's better to just preach, you know, various topics. And what I love about the Bible is you find both of those things in there. Sometimes you find stuff sort of sequentially going through in an order, and we've done things like that. Like we'll go through the book of Jonah chapter by chapter. We went through the book of Romans kind of chapter by chapter. Other times we just kind of go on a topic like the power of habit in your life. And what I sort of see that reflected in scriptures, and so I kind of enjoy the fact that we do that often on Sunday mornings. So we do a little bit of both. But getting into the book of Luke, he talks about something here which is sort of at the crux of a lot of what you see throughout the scripture. It's something I talk about almost every single Sunday, so you may know what's coming. But it's also what makes Christianity so hard. Because we sort of live in a fast-paced world where we kind of want the cliff notes for things. We kind of want to get the summary statement. Even now, when I was learning in website development, web pages are great because they sort of shrink everything down. Like if you see more than 4 paragraphs on a website, you're going to skip it. That's why Facebook has even gone by the wayside sometimes to Instagram, because Instagram is just a short little statement. Twitter is, what, 148 characters, whatever it is, just really short statements. And we kind of like just the bullet points. Just tell me what I need to know, Jesus. Just give me the stuff I got to do. Give me the stuff I shouldn't do. Just kind of give me the highlights of what it is that you expect out of me. And what you find, rather, with Jesus is he never really gives you that list, which is kind of frustrating. He never really gives you the bullet point thing of stuff you can, you know, have to do, don't have to do. And so when you really ask him, you know, what does it mean to be a Christian, it's he defines Christianity in a way that's different than what we've sort of made it nowadays. Now, if you ask 20 people what it means to be a Christian, you'll probably get 20 different answers. Because we have denominational Christians, we have Pharisaical, legalistic Christians, we have charismatic Christians, we have the pious Stoic Christians. The pious Stoic ones would probably not have done anything during that last worship set, but were, if you went to Night of Worship, you had a great time. Anybody come to Night of Worship? Good time. It was awesome. If you missed it, you missed out. Yeah, you can get up for Night of Worship. That was good. So the rest of y'all who are clapping, you have no idea what you're clapping for, but it was a great time. But it was not a time for a Stoic pious one. Stoic pious ones are the ones who go, that was a good song. Praise Jesus. And that's about as charismatic as they get. And they somehow feel like as if God's going to be offended if they move in any way, shape, or form. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the charismatic Christian who feels like as if they're not running up and down the aisles with streamers, then you really don't love Jesus. And so all of that sort of become, and so people walk in and are like, you know, I remember one guy told me, he's like, you know, I'm not quite ready for tier 2 Christianity. I said, what's that? He goes, you know, where you get into it during the worship. I'm like, That's not a thing, okay? That may be their thing. That's just not a thing. It's kind of odd where people come up with this stuff. But Jesus talks about one central thing. But what's funny is even when we read stuff he says, we will read into it our own theological ideas, and we will just assume he has to be talking about a list. Like in Luke 14, if you take it sort of out of the context or don't see the flow of Luke 14 or don't understand the thematic flow of it, you'll read parts towards the end where he says, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. We're in Luke 14, 28. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, hey, that person will build but wasn't able to finish. Now, this is a verse that haunts me because I do a lot of building stuff. And you know who ridicules you the most, or the least of the fear, who I fear the ridicule from the most? The lady at Home Depot at the checkout. Oh, back again? Oh, forget a few things? I mean, isn't that what they say? If you go to the same checkout person over and over and over again, like 4 times in one day at Home Depot, it's like, yeah, I couldn't figure out how much I'd need. I'm not really good at this estimating thing. You know, I don't want to buy too much. Because anyway, so it always haunts me, this passage, on multiple levels. But we read this and we assume that he's talking about here, like, yeah, if you're going to be a Christian, you better know the stuff you got to do and the stuff you shouldn't be doing. Because, you know, you don't want to just go out there and tell everybody you're Christian, not be able to live up to all the stuff that's expected out of you. You got to count the cost, because if you can't do all the stuff that Jesus tells you to do, or if you won't quit doing all the stuff he tells you to quit doing, then you're really, you know, not going to cut it, really be kind of a waste of time. That's usually the way we sort of think of when we read a passage like this. But there's sort of a flow to the conversation before he gets there. And to kind of understand that, we got to go back up and kind of begin up at the top, which is where we'll hit in 1 second. And I'll kind of cut to the cliff notes, since that's what you want anyway. At the end of the day, he's going to be talking about where your heart's at. And that's the hard thing. Because sometimes we don't even know where our heart is at. It's so much easier just to give a checklist. If there's just a few things I can do, I can do it. If there's things you want me to quit doing, I can quit doing that. But, you know, if you want my heart, I can't even tell you where my heart is. The heart is deceitful above all things. Sometimes I can think my heart is one place, but it really isn't there at all. And the problem with the checklist version of Christianity is if you read through a lot of the places in the Bible, there's people who do all the stuff on the checklist that you might think sounds really like godly or spiritual, or that person must love Jesus with all the stuff they're doing, but you'll find God's got a commentary on it when their heart's not there. Like you'll read over in Amos chapter 5, this could be a great verse for you to quote, hopefully never hear, but anyways, he says, "I hate and despise your religious festivals. Your religious services stink." Now, he's talking about the fact that they would burn this fragrant offering, like a fragrant incense, and so he's like, it doesn't really smell very good to me, but I just think it's funny. He says, your church service stinks. And then he says, you know, away with these noise of your songs. That just sounds like a grumpy old man, doesn't it? Ah, the noise. I had a guy at one church I went to. He did not like the guitar and the drums being brought into the church, so he would stand on the front row and go, And I think his heart was in a different place than where God's at. God's like, that's how I feel when you play songs, because your heart's not in. It's just all a big show. He says, I won't listen to your music. Isaiah 21:13. This is something Jesus quotes a lot of times. He says, these people, they come to meet near to me with their mouth, but they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship of me is really based on a bunch of human rules that they've been taught. In other words, they're just following a bunch of do's and don'ts, and they're just trying to sort of put on the show of it, but their heart's not with me. And that's what he's going to be talking about. That's the theme of Luke chapter 14. And he starts off and he says, on this one particular Sabbath, Jesus was at the home of a very prominent Pharisee. And sitting there in front of him was a man who had, make sure I find where the verse is, a man who had abnormal swelling of his body. Now, oh, and it says, and he was being carefully watched by the Pharisees. Now, a little just side thing. Oftentimes, when you read things about Jesus, so often I see Christians jump straight to sort of the supernatural, mystical. Like they're like, oh, see, Jesus had sort of this clairvoyance where he could read the minds of everybody in the room. That's how he knew what was going on. And I think sometimes if you back up, I don't think you're giving Jesus enough credit for just the simple fact that he was an observant person. Okay, like, some of y'all, I give you, and there's some people who can walk in a room and they can read a room pretty quick and they can kind of get a feel for what's going on. And it doesn't take a genius, though, to read this room. I mean, listen to just what the pieces he gives you there. All right, so you're at the home of a very prominent Pharisee. Okay, a Pharisee was one who prided themselves on being ceremonially clean. In other words, they would purify themselves and they would always be at any time ready to be able to walk into the temple or walk into any holy place being sort of clean before God. Now, there were various things that could make you unclean. One of those, by chance, if you didn't know, was to be in contact with or in having in your house somebody who was unclean. By the way, if you had a physical abnormality or a sickness, you were considered unclean. So did you get the setting? It's a Sabbath. They're at a party at a Pharisee's house, and who do they seat right across from Jesus but a guy who has this abnormal kind of swelling of the body. Already you should be going, how did he get invited? And kind of curious they put him right across from Jesus, isn't it? Yes, it is. I don't think Jesus was using clairvoyance at this point. I think he just sort of looked at this and go, really? Really? And meanwhile, over on the other side of the room, they're all like, I mean, I don't think he had to use supernatural powers to figure out this was a setup, right? And what's the setup? Well, the setup is in the other two clues you see in there. It's a Sabbath, and there's a guy across from him who needs physical healing. And the Pharisees already heard stories of Jesus healing, and not just healing, but healing on the Sabbath, no less. And it says the Ten Commandments, what was it, what number is it about the Sabbath, anybody? Fourth, yeah, it is the fourth. The fourth commandment says you should rest on the day of Sabbath, rest from all your labor and all your work. And so they thought it was a sin to heal on the Sabbath. So they heard these reports of Jesus healing on the Sabbath, and they kind of wanted to catch him in the act. And they also were kind of a trap, because on the one hand, if he heals this guy on the Sabbath, then he's breaking the law of God, so therefore he can't possibly be of God, and they can discredit his whole ministry. On the other hand, if he refuses to heal this guy, they can discredit him, because either they can go around saying, he didn't have the power to do it, or he wasn't willing to do it, whatever it may be, they could kind of get him both ways. They get him coming, going, whatever he does, they got him, okay? So what does Jesus do? He kind of sees the setup, and he looks over, he goes, I got a question for you guys. Should I heal him or not? See what he does there? He puts the trap back on them. The very trap they're trying to get him in, he puts it on them before they can do anything. And they're like, darn it, because if we tell him that he shouldn't, then we come across very callous and cold. If we tell him that we should, well, then we're the ones telling him he ought to break the commandment. So I didn't hear anything, did you? No, I didn't hear anything. So they just sit there quiet. So after he sort of calls them out on it, it says they remained silent. So Jesus took hold of the man, he healed him, and he sent him away. So then it says, so we asked him, all right, if one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, would you not immediately pull it out? And once again, they had nothing to say. Now, a couple things here. What he's basically saying, listen, you've got all these rules. Your whole understanding of following after God is all summarized down on these sense of these things that you do and things that you don't do. And it's somehow void of any sense of compassion. Yet, you know, if you had something at stake here, I mean, you brought this guy in who's got this physical abnormality, probably was shocked that he got invited, only to find out along the way that he's getting completely used in the whole process. And the whole thing's a setup so that if he is actually helped in this situation, you can just use it as an opportunity to hurt the one who is trying to help him. And so there's just no compassion here whatsoever for this guy who's just a pawn in their whole little religious game and scheme. And he's saying, let's just say this guy wasn't somebody who was meaningless to you. What if that was your son? What if you had something at stake in this? Wouldn't you begin to look at those rules differently? Wouldn't you look at this and, you know, if there's any way, if there's any loophole where I could help somebody that I love, if your son was hurting on this day, wouldn't you have wanted him to be healed? Or he goes and, see, it's funny. If you read this in different passages, different translations will translate this animal differently, but I'm going to stick with the NIV, and Jesus simply says, you know, if it was your ox on the line, you'd do something different. See, I don't know whether you caught that because you know the King James or because you know other slang. But anyways, it doesn't matter. He says, you know, if it was your ox on the line, if it was your ox at stake, you'd have done something different in this situation because you love yourself and you care about your economic prosperity and you care about the things that you care about. But clearly, you don't care about anybody else other than yourself, because when it's your ox, you'll do something. When it's your son, you'll do something. But when it's just this guy, this nameless, meaningless, you'll use him. You don't care. Your rules are so much more important because you don't have any heart or any compassion. You don't understand where God's heart is at. And you can't understand what I'm going to do in this moment or why I did what I did because you don't understand who God is and you don't have a heart for God. You just love yourself. And he says, you know, as I'm looking around this room, I mean, that's all I see. Verse 7, he says he noticed how the guests had picked out the places of honor at the table. So he told them this parable. If somebody invites you to a wedding feast, don't take the place of honor, because, you know, somebody more distinguished than you may have also been invited. And then the host who invited both of you is going to come to you and say, hey, you should give this person your seat. Then humiliated, you'll have to take the seat of the least important place. But then when you're invited, if you're invited and you take the lowest seat, perhaps maybe the host might come to you and say, hey, you need to move up to a better place. Then you'll be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Then he said to the host, you know, when you give a luncheon or dinner, don't just invite your friends, your brothers and sisters, relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they might invite you back, and you'll be repaid. But if you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Though they can't repay you, you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So he's saying, listen, you know, you know, this ethic of love, you're so focused on yourself, whether you're attending a party or whether you're inviting people to your party, whether you're an attendee or you're a host, your whole focus and your whole infatuation is yourself. You've never been to a party that you haven't shown up to and thought to yourself, this is all about me. You've gone to somebody else's wedding, and it's supposed to be their special day, yet you show up and think this whole party's for you. It's their birthday, but you think this party's in your honor. You think this is all about you and should run according to your schedule and should be the way that you want it. It's all about you everywhere you go. And when you have a party, the whole way you design your guest list is always thinking about, who should we invite? Who invited us? Whose party do I want to go to? You know, the Samsons, they throw a really good party. Let's invite them to our party so maybe we can get an invite to their party. You know, we got to invite my boss because, you know, I want to make sure we get a raise, promotion, and, you know, after all, Kimberly invited our boss to her party, and so I don't want her to get a leg up on me in the office. He's like, stop all that. It's ridiculous. You know, maybe you should just invite somebody who, is there anybody out there who you could just make their day, make their year by getting an invitation? Because probably nobody invites that person. Why don't you invite somebody like that? You know, if you had somebody who can't do anything for you, your social status, your ego, anything, just reach out to somebody like that. Throw a party for them. Put them on the guest list. You know, if you had an ethic that loved somebody other than yourself, you would. Now, before I go on, I forgot there was one point I got to make about this other thing up here, and it's because it's something that came up years ago. There's a modern version of this legalism that I see with these Pharisees here, and it came to me a couple years back. I got a phone call from a counselor who'd said, I've got this really difficult situation. This lady is being physically abused by her husband to the point where she comes into my office with bruises, but their pastor has told her that the only reason she can divorce is if he's committing adultery or he leaves, because abuse is not a biblical reason for divorce. And I said, this is ridiculous, and I quoted this verse. I said, you know, over in the Old Testament, it says you're not allowed to beat your donkey. You're not allowed to beat your ox. But if your ox was hurting, you'd break the rule and you'd get him out of the pit on a Sunday. Get this lady out of this pit. Break whatever rule you have to. She shouldn't be in this situation. If it wasn't okay to beat your donkey like this, I don't think God's like, you know, I don't want you hurting the farm animals, but I don't care what you do to your wife. I mean, do you see what happens when you get legalistic with this? It goes to a really bad place. And you lose the capacity to be able to rightly understand Scripture when you try to understand Scripture without understanding and knowing God's heart. So going back to the party thing. So what's hilarious about this whole thing, after he talks about how you think every party is about yourself, random dude, we're going to call him Harold. Harold's like, oh, party. Hey, Jesus, it'll be pretty cool to come to God's party. Now, if you've ever taught a Bible study, especially with little kids, you get this all the time. You'll be like, all right, so Jesus was there with his disciples having his last supper. I had fish last night for supper. We went to McDonald's. Fish filet. Now, see, the reason why I struggle sometimes in kids' church, I'll be like, thanks, Timmy. Next time you want to comment, make sure it applies to the lesson. All right, moving on. right? Here's what's so amazing about this moment, okay? This guy's like, it'd be pretty cool to come to God's party, right? Right? Okay, does that have anything to do with what Jesus just talked about? No, nothing at all. The only thing in common was I was talking about a party and a dinner. Oh, I'll talk about a party and a dinner. And we're talking about God, I'm sure, so we'll talk about God has a party, right? It'd be pretty cool to that party, huh, Jesus? Now, what's awesome about Jesus' response is on two levels. Number one is he does what a great teacher does. He incorporates little Timmy's trip to McDonald's into his lesson as though it was a part of the lesson, as though he was just waiting for Timmy to tell about his dinner so he could get into the next part of the lesson. That was a perfect catapult to go where he's going next. Okay? You know what that is? That is Jesus not just teaching about love, but being an example of it while he's teaching about it. Do you get that? You see, the compassionate response when somebody blurts out, oh, I went to McDonald's last night. See, the hard part I struggle with is being like, okay, why is that relevant to this? And I want to embarrass them and call them out so they'll quit interrupting my Bible study, right? If you come to men's group, that's pretty much what I do, right? But that's kind of a way you show men love. is it not? I don't know. You know, only two guys are going to look at each other and say, ah, what's a dirty old scoundrel like you doing with a good-looking girl like that? I mean, no girl's ever going to say that to another girl, right? But I digress. All right, so I'm not Jesus. He teaches much better and much differently than I do. He's teaching about the love of God and how we should have a love for God. This guy throws in something that has nothing to do with the topic, and Jesus' response could not be more loving in the way that he handles it. Do you see this? He's like, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, Harold. Let's go with that. You know, God is going to throw a party someday, and he wants to invite everybody to come. And he does, as a matter of fact. He throws this party. And it's like this, you know, a certain man is preparing a banquet who invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sends his servant out to tell those who'd been invited, come on, everything is ready. But they all began to make excuses. The first said, I've just bought a field, you know, I got to go see it, so I can't come. The next says, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out, so you got to excuse me. The other one just said, hey, I just got married. Now, if you don't get the humor in that, it's hilarious. See, the Bible's funnier than you give him credit, and Jesus is funnier than you give him credit for. He's like, you know, this first guy's like, I got this business thing, and he gives this whole long list of reasons why the business thing's more important. The next guy's like, I just got some new ox, I got a new vehicle, you know, I'm going to go try it out, I want to take it for a spin. The last guy doesn't give any explanation other than just saying, I just got married, man. You know, right? I don't got to say nothing, right? Right? It's just, he didn't give any more details than that. Sorry, if you don't think that's funny, you're missing out the fun of Scripture. All right. So the servant comes back and tells all this to the master. So the owner of the house became very angry, and he ordered his servant, go out into the streets, the alleyways of the town, and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what you ordered has been done, but there's still more room. He says, all right, go out into the country roads and lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who originally invited will get to taste my banquet. Now, understand this story. You ever thrown a party and had nobody show up? That stinks, doesn't it? You ever had one of your kids have a birthday party and had nobody come? Oh, it's funny, is it? Sorry, no, I'm just kidding. Sorry. I'm sure you're laughing about something totally different. Right? Right? Okay. It was hilarious. Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. It happened to one of my kids. It just, you know, I had to work that night. I had a church function. It was y'all's fault. I had a church function. feel bad. So we, you know, we're like, no big deal. We'll schedule the birthday party early in the morning. Not realizing that, like, early mornings in that time of year, kids have ball games and basketballs and baseballs and everything else. And so, you know, all these kids were forced to, you know, choose between going and having fun or their commitment to their team. And there's a lot of good reasons. And, you know, I don't fault them for that. They should be committed to their team. And, you know, they have a responsibility and obligation there. They don't want their whole team to forfeit. But I can't explain that anything. Any of that doesn't make any sense to my son, right? How's he feel? Totally unloved. Totally uncared about. And he's like, you know, God's inviting everybody to the party, and he doesn't feel loved when there's other things that are more important to you in your life than to be in a relationship with him. Let me flip it. You ever been invited to a party and you're the only one who showed up? If you ever get that opportunity, go. And you're like, well, how am I going to know? I'll tell you how you're going to know. Because you got the invite, and you had the same thought everybody else who had the invite thought. I don't want to go to this. I do not want to. Come on, who's been there, right? I do not. No, I cannot spend a night there. Listen, you're not the only one who felt that. Now, what I'm about to say next always sounds odd coming out of my mouth, and I'm still not comfortable with it, but hey, it's my life. I can't run from it. It is what it is. Both my wives that I've been married to, that just sounds weird coming out. Someday I'll get used to it. Both the women I've been married to have both had the opportunity to be the only person at a party where the only person they showed up. With Melissa, I'll never forget, it was a girl who was a dancer at our church who had gotten pregnant by her boyfriend, and she threw a baby shower for herself. Just let that sink in to begin with. There was enough there for 30 people, and Melissa was the only one who showed up. And see, what happens, Melissa, she would always win all the party games. So I don't know, she's like an expert at bridal shower, baby shower games, right? So she came in the door, and I'm like, so, what'd you win? And she's like, everything. And I'm like, what? You didn't say anything for anybody else? She goes, there was nobody else. I'm like, what? Now, as a pastor of a church, knowing she invited a bunch of our church people, I was furious, okay, with myself for poor leadership, just that, you know, nobody in our church understood the heart of Christ or what it means to be a follower of Christ. And then I was just heartbroken for her, right? But I remember looking at Melissa and saying this, you know, she may throw another 100 parties and may attend another 100 parties in her life, but she will never forget you and your friendship and what that means to her because you were the only one who showed up. Never pass up on that opportunity. And God's talking about this relationship with us and how a lot of people are passing up that opportunity. And you can give 1,000 good reasons why you don't have time for God. And there's a lot of really good ones. But at the end of the day, it's just communicating one thing and one thing only. There's something else more important than you, God. And it communicates unlove. There's no way around it. There's no way I can tell my son when nobody shows up for his birthday party, hey, all your friends really love you. Yeah, sure they do, Dad. Sure they do. It just doesn't compute. He says, it's going to be like that someday. So Harold, thank you for bringing that up. You brought up a really good point. See how loving that is back around with Harold this whole time too? And then he says this. He says, if anybody comes to me and doesn't hate their father and mother, their wife and their children, their brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Now, this is not a reason not to call mom or dad on Mother's Day and Father's Day. We looked at this language a couple weeks ago. This is a hate by comparison. In other words, this is, you know, my love for God would be so much, anything you would compare to would be hate by comparison. This same comparison is used back in the Old Testament. There's this guy named Jacob who gets married to this girl named Rachel. He wants to get married to her. He goes to her father, says, I want to marry your daughter. And he says, you got to work for me for 7 years. You give me 7 years of labor, you can earn the opportunity to be married to my daughter. So he does it. And he's like, you know, those 7 years were like a week. They're like 7 days to me. I just can't wait to get married. And so what happens is the dad throws an open bar party. See, the Bible is more close to your life than you realize. So he has an open bar. He gets Jacob drunk and ends up getting him married to the older sister. Now, all I'm going to say about the older sister is it says in the text that Rachel was really easy on the eyes, Leah not so much. So he wakes up the next morning realizing in his drunken stupor he married the wrong girl. And he's like, you tricked me. And he's like, what do you mean I tricked you? It was our custom. You had to know you were going to marry the older before the younger. If you know Jacob, that's kind of funny that happened to Jacob. Just it is. Okay, so he's like, well, I still want to marry Rachel. He ends up working another 7 years for this girl, right? You know, the longer and the more you have to work for something, the more you're going to appreciate it, right? Let that be a lesson to parents and all you want to give them all their stuff. The more you earn something, the more you work for them, the more you wait for something, the more you appreciate it. She's been the object of his affection for 14 years, and he just cannot wait, and he finally gets married to her. And it says the kind of affection that he showered over her, it was by comparison like as if he hated Leah. Now that doesn't mean he hated Leah, but I would probably tell you if you asked Leah, she'd probably tell you she did feel like she was hated in that relationship. Because a love for one was so much greater. It's a comparison term is the point. He loved Leah, but by comparison, it was like as if he hated her compared to the way he loved on Rachel. It's kind of a similar analogy of saying, you know, all the stars that you saw last night are still up in the sky. You know that, right? You just can't see them right now. Why? Because the power of the sun is so much greater. That when the sun is out, by comparison, you can't see anything else. Nothing else is even distinguishable because of the great love. And he's saying your love for God should be so great that, you know, that your love for anything else would be completely indistinguishable in comparison to your great love for God. And then you look at the depth and the breadth of this. Now, think of all the different relationships he talks about here. You know, think about the difference in your relationship between your parents and your spouse and your kids and your brother and sister. It's like your parents is, you know, it starts off as a very needy, you know, I love my parents because of what they give me. And then it moves to, I resent my parents because of what they won't let me. And then as you get older, you kind of have this, it sort of ages like a fine wine. Like you have this deep appreciation for the sacrifices they made. You have the ability to, at some point, to have grace to realize, you know, my parents weren't perfect. But, you know, they really did a good job with what they had and what they had to deal with and everything that was going on, and now see it from a different perspective, and you have this sense of appreciation for what they've done for you and the sacrifices they've made for you, and you have a you know, very unique kind of love at some point in life for them often. But that's totally different the way you love your wife. I mean, like that love relationship like took a while to kind of mature, whereas with a spouse, it's like, woohoo! You know, it starts off real big, and then sometimes it can fade like the opposite way, or sometimes it can kind of go ups and downs, and you know, it can be the kind of thing where it's just this, you know, this joyous, continuous, wild ride of passion and thrill and lulls and highs and lows, and it's a crazy thing, isn't it? Love is a crazy thing. But then your love for your kids is totally different than that, right? Like, there's days I don't like my kids, but I always love them, right? No matter what they do, I always love them. I'm like, but I love them. You know, it's like you can't not love them. You just like you have this innate love for them, and then like your brother, your sister, right? Can't help but love them, right? I mean, it's a sort of odd sort of thing. It's like no matter what they do, you're like, well, he's my brother. You know, what am I gonna? Is it my brother? You know, my brother. So there's all these different kinds of loves and all these different degrees and levels of loves. And a lot of times these loves will compete with each other. Like sometimes your love for your mama might compete with your love for your husband or your wife, right? If you don't think so, maybe they do, all right? And sometimes your love for the kids might compete with your love for the spouse. And sometimes I know my kids think that you know, I'm choosing mom over them. I'm like, duh. I mean, got me. But the thing about it is if you have a greater love for God than anything else, it never competes with those loves. It fuels them. Now, you can make your love for God compete with those things. Like, you can, you know, choose, you know, other people over God. But when you choose God over everything else, you'll see that it fuels every other kind of love in your life. You with me on that? You will love them far more deeply and far more passionately because of your love for God. And then he sums it up and he says, whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. And so he brings in the analogy of the cross. And what was the cross? It was the greatest act of sacrificial love this world has ever seen. Until we saw the way Christ loved us, we didn't even know what love was. We had no concept of love until we saw what Christ did on the cross. And it's really comforting when you think about, you know, this in terms of discipleship. Is, you know, if he had said, if anybody doesn't get the hangman's noose and jump off the tree ledge, you can't be my disciple. Now, I know that may sound kind of gory and shocking, but the only reason why that sounds gory and shocking and the cross thing doesn't is because we've so sanitized and religiousized, that's a word, we religiousized the word cross that you think of it this beautiful, glorious thing, and you still think of a hangman's noose as something awful. They were the same thing. They're both means of execution and death. You get me on that? Just about every other form of death, though, is a very quick process, right? Stoning, hanging, you know, modern-day firing squad, electric chair, whatever, it's all pretty quick. The cross thing, though, was a very slow process. Now, to begin with, starting in chapter 9, Jesus is on his way to the... He's already on the road to the cross, okay? And then when he gets to Jerusalem, he has got to go through the trial. Eventually, they're going to put a cross on his back. He's going to carry it up the hill, okay? He's still on the road to crucifixion. He eventually then is going to be nailed to that cross. Now, he dies in 6 hours. That's because he doesn't get killed. He gives up his life. That's pretty clear. The reason why we know this is because the other two guys alongside of him, they weren't dead yet, and usually it takes anywhere from a day to 7 days or so for somebody to die on a cross. It's a very slow, slow death. And what I love about this picture is the discipleship process and growing in a loving relationship with God doesn't happen overnight. This is a process. Your road to becoming a sacrificially loving person towards God and having a loving relationship that lasts for all eternity, it's a process, people. And you need to be patient with yourself and you need to be patient with the people around you. Churches go real sideways when we aren't patient with other people's growth. And your relationship with God is going to go real sideways if you're not patient with your own growth in this area. This takes time to be a sacrificial lover of God and a sacrificial lover of other people. It takes time. It's a road. It's not a hangman's noose. It's a cross. And it takes time. The sacrificial death takes time. And then he ends all this by saying, count the cost. Count the cost. I was doing a wedding yesterday, and I always meet with the bride and the groom before the ceremony, and so I'm in there talking with one of them, and I was like, it's last chance to bail. Now, that may seem odd, okay, but that's pretty much, if you've done marriage counseling with me or pre-marriage counseling with me, that's pretty much what I open up every single session with. Y'all sure you still want to do this? I mean, you know, really, easier now to get out of this than later. No court fees, no law fees. It's really easy. It's quick and easy. All you got to do is say, I'm done, and one of y'all gets and walks out. That's it. I'll give the other one a ride home if you need me to, okay? It's really easy to end this now. It's cheap and easy to get into this, but it's very expensive to get out of this. So if we're not sure, let's just get out now. And so I asked him one more time, like, hey, it's going to be embarrassing. It's a little odd right now, but hey, it's easier now than any other time. You sure you don't want out? And so it kind of sparked this conversation where the bride was sitting there telling all of her bridesmaid friends or whatnot. She's like, yeah, he's always been trying to talk us out of this. And they're like, odd pastor. And she's like, no, it's great. It's really great. Because, you know, like, it was like one thing. Like, I want to make sure we really knew what we were getting into. And that's it. If you're going to get into a marriage, you better count the cost, right? I mean, this is going to be the closest sacrificial kind of love that you're going to have to your relationship with God. It's going to emulate your relationship with God probably more and better ways than any other relationship you're going to have. You're going to have to give of yourself sacrificially day in and day out. You will be carrying your cross every day of that relationship. This person will make you more miserable than anybody else ever will. I tell them that in the marriage counseling. You sure you want to do this? Count the cost. Don't get in this. Don't get halfway in this and have to make 5 trips back to Home Depot because you weren't sure about this. If you're going to do this, do this. Count the cost. If you're going to love God, love God. If he's going to be number one in your life, make him number one in your life. But if you're not sure about this thing, then don't go out wearing the t-shirt, all right? Make sure you know what it is you're getting yourself into. Let's close and pray. Father, I thank you for your great love for each and every one of us, understanding the patience that it takes to deal with each of us. What a slow and gradual process this has been to move my heart to where I can begin to love you more than I love myself. Catch me at the right time, I'm doing it. Catch me at the wrong time, I forgot about it. What a slow process. I thank you for all your grace along every step of the way. So, Father, we cry out and just ask that you would continue to give us grace, that we might continue to walk that cross, that road to the cross before us. We might sacrificially love you the same way that you've loved us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.